Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 17th of October 2012 here in Japan. It is the 16th of October 2012 in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by our guest Rick Rozoff of Stop NATO International at rickrozoff.wordpress.com. Rick, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us once again today.
Yeah, it's equally a pleasure to be with you, James. Thanks for having me.
Well, it is a pleasure to chat with you because you are a fount of knowledge on matters geopolitical, so it is great to be able to pick your brain. But unfortunately, we are not talking about a happy subject today. We are talking about the growing expansion of NATO around the world, its growing threat in various theaters, is sometimes in surprising ways for something that claims to be a North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And we've touched on this issue in some of our previous conversations, but I wanted to draw this out in greater detail today. Let's start by talking about some of the ways that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is beginning to branch out into areas that are far, far beyond its original purview and mandate. Let's talk about some of where is NATO expanding to these days, and what kinds of alliances is it forming around the world?
First of all, I appreciate the ironic tone in your voice when you referred to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because it certainly is a misnomer, perhaps history's greatest, next to the Defense Department, arguably. The 12 founding members of NATO in 1949, 63 years ago, in fact, all shared coastlines on or fairly near the North Atlantic Ocean. The organization, as you know, has expanded in the interim to 28 full members, actually increasing by 75% in the decade between 1999 and 2009, where the U.S.-led military bloc went from 16 countries to 28 countries. Of those 16 new additions, or of those 12 new additions, rather, none of them are anywhere near the Atlantic Ocean, north or otherwise. But in the interim, in the, you know, the post-Cold War era, in the last 21 years, we've also seen the expansion of what NATO refers to as military partnerships, the largest of which is the Partnership for Peace, which was employed to groom the 12 new members that entered the alliance as full members between 1999 and 2009. But it currently has in excess of 20 members. And then there are a number of other regional military partnerships, such as the Mediterranean Dialogue, which takes in North Africa and the Middle East. To date, there are 7 countries. There are Mauritania, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Jordan, and Israel. Libya has already been marked for membership since the overthrow of the government there following NATO's air war of last year. And if NATO, U.S. and NATO have their way, Syria and Lebanon would likely join the Mediterranean Dialogue NATO military partnership. So that takes care of almost the entire Mediterranean basin. In 2004, at the NATO summit in Istanbul, Turkey, yet another partnership was launched, something, it's an eponymous one, it's called the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, and includes formally 4 of the 6 members of the Gulf Cooperation Council in the Persian Gulf, that is all except Saudi Arabia and Oman, but the latter two are also involved in varying degrees in that partnership. NATO would like, I'm sure, to incorporate nations like Iraq and Yemen in the Gulf Cooperation Council as well. But earlier this year, ahead of the summit in Chicago in May, NATO launched a non-geographically specific, if you will, global partnership called Partners Across the Globe, which today takes in Asia-Pacific countries in the broadest sense of Asia, including Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Mongolia, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, Japan, and more to come, no doubt. So if you tabulate those, if you add them all up, you're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 nations, which is, you know, comfortably well over a third of the countries in the world, now are either full members of or affiliates of a U.S.-controlled military bloc. To give, you know, your viewers and listeners some comprehension of the scope and the scale of what's been perpetrated over the past generation.
It is a remarkable expansion, and it does raise the question of whether or not there's an actual strategy behind this expansion. Is it expanding in certain key areas for certain reasons, or is it simply a quest to expand as far as possible?
Yeah, that's a good question, James. You know, whether it's inherent momentum that just pushes it forward, but I would suggest there's a broader, ultimately global geopolitical objective at work here. When NATO was set up in 1949, the following year, the United States, with a number of its, new NATO allies, entered into war in the Korean Peninsula. And, you know, new NATO prospective nations, Turkey and Greece, for example, sent troops under U.S. command, nominally under United Nations command, in Korea and earned their spurs, if you will, and then shortly thereafter became full members of NATO. But what the United States did in conjunction with Britain and France and so in a couple of instances was to set up other regional military formations modeled after NATO, such as the Central Treaty Organization, you know, formerly the Baghdad Pact, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, the Australia-New Zealand-U.S. Treaty Organization. But what we've seen in the post-Cold War era, you know, since the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Socialist Bloc, the Warsaw Pact, in its military configuration, is that the U.S. has not only revived and expanded NATO, but in many senses, rather than reviving those other military blocs which were modeled after NATO, has expanded NATO into a global role where it's in essence incorporating the various member states of the other military blocs I mentioned.
Let's talk about some of the people who are supposedly on the other end of this gun barrel that NATO represents. And I suppose in this case, in the long term, we're talking about China and Russia. And we can see a coordinated strategy of containment that's happening around the globe, not only through NATO, but of course through all the military alliances that it contains under its umbrella. Let's talk about where Russia and China fall into this and how you expect this to be playing out in the future.
You've identified, you know, two of the three key targets of motivating or animating the creation of a global NATO, which are Russia and China. The third, of course, is Iran. And the creation of the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative in 2004 in the Persian Gulf was aimed squarely and exclusively at Iran. We have to be clear about that. The deployment in January of this year of an X-band transportable interceptor missile radar facility in Turkey, which is part of the NATO, U.S. and NATO, so-called European Phase Adaptive Approach, son of Star Wars missile shield, is also aimed, nominally at Iran, and in fact, in part, it's also aimed at Russia. So the three countries on the Eurasian landmass that present, any sort of impediment to plans by the United States and its Western and Eastern and Persian Gulf allies for global domination are, in fact, the two you've mentioned, Russia and China, Iran being the third. And the expansion of NATO, if you watch, you know, where it's happening, initially, of course, it was irrefutable that the expansion of NATO into 12, the incorporation, rather, of 12 new members, all of them in Eastern Europe, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, was, of course, an initiative aimed at the encirclement of Russia, which in large part has been accomplished. It's now China's turn. And the fact that the U.S. is going to deploy X-band transportable radars of the sort that are in Turkey and was placed, in fact, in Israel 4 years ago in the Negev Desert is part of what is clearly much more than just a continent-wide European missile system, but is a global one in Japan, you know, with talk about placing another perhaps in Southeast Asia, you know, perhaps the Philippines. Indicates clearly that China is now to see replicated around it the model that was used with NATO expansion in Europe towards Russia. And the increased integration of countries bordering Iran, Azerbaijan comes most immediately to mind, as well as the buildup in the Persian Gulf with NATO participation, indicates that the encirclement of Iran is also underway.
The picture that's being painted is a particularly bleak one because it seems that there are no countervailing forces against this move towards confrontation between the major military powers, and it seems like an inevitable process at this point. But do you see anything that's happening on the geopolitical stage that would be any sort of counterbalance to what we see in this growing NATO confrontational stance?
That's a very probing and valuable question. I should emphasize, as I think is implicit in your question, that, you know, any sort of resistance is at this point is not only welcome, but it's bold and it's, something maybe not to have been anticipated, considering the fact that the West, the U.S. in the first instance, has had 21 years to consolidate its grasp, of power throughout the world in the face of no viable, challenger with the breakup of the Soviet Union. The U.S. was, pretty much at an open road to extend its military tentacles throughout the globe, which in fact it has done. But a couple of developments that haven't, I think, been properly taken note of, James, that are worth looking at, is the fact that the head of the Pakistani military recently returned from a visit to Moscow. The foreign minister of Pakistan was recently in Russia as well. And we've seen statements emanate out of the meeting of the foreign ministers of Russia and Pakistan recently asserted a common position in relation to the events in Syria, which is to say condemning any attempts at foreign intervention, which would be a combination, of course, of the U.S. and its NATO allies, with its Persian Gulf allies like Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. So we've seen a major shift where, arguably, one of the major military allies of the United States throughout the post-Cold War, the World War II period, Pakistan, seems to be reevaluating its position, orienting increasingly towards the nations of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the two prime movers in the SCO, of course, being Russia and China, along with four of the five former Soviet Central Asian republics, and increasingly an observer and other affiliated statuses, nations like Pakistan, India, Iran, Mongolia, Belarus, Sri Lanka, Afghanistan. And we're seeing the evolution of a, what is basically an economic and a trade, but I think will quickly become a collective security apparatus that can manage, say, events in Afghanistan and in the general region, if and when NATO and the United States vacate Afghanistan. That's number one. Number two, we've seen the no one less than the head of state of Iraq, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, go to Russia last week, where not only did he sign an arms deal with Russia for something in the neighborhood of $5 billion, but he openly and explicitly warned NATO not to become involved in Syria. A statement echoed today, by the way, by the president of Iran. You used the word gun barrel, gun barrel a few minutes ago. And the president of Iran actually said that democracy will not come out of the NATO's gun barrels. So we're seeing the evolution or the emergence of, very interesting and I would say, hitherto unpredictable alliances, in the greater Middle East in the first place, and hopefully we'll see it elsewhere. We do have to keep in mind, of course, ALBA, or the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of Our America, in Central America, Central and South America, and the Caribbean being a, being an outpost of resistance to efforts by the West to achieve not only global military, but economic and political domination.
Well, as you indicate, it is interesting to see this trend developing, and it will be interesting to see how this plays out in the form of potentially rival security apparatuses like this, the SCO. But for those of us who I assume are the vast majority of the audience listening to this right now, most people out there are not actually part of these international delegations. They're not in positions of political power. They are average citizens like you and I who hopefully are concerned about this and would like to do whatever they can to actually put the brakes on this agenda towards what seems to be an inevitable militarization of the globe. What is it that you think that the average citizen can do to actually raise awareness of and actually do something to hopefully change this agenda?
I'm glad you raised that question. There is quite a bit, and we'll discuss it in a moment. But, we have to acknowledge, first of all, under the adage to never underestimate your adversary, certainly not in war, that the political oligarchies reigning in my country, in the United States, and then, its allied countries in Canada and Europe, in the NATO nations, where we'll have something in the neighborhood of a $2 billion election culminating on November 6th in this country, and the access for people into the media, the average citizen, or into the political process in any meaningful sense is so severely constricted that, at least in terms of traditional or formal, methods of influencing public policy, we're limited severely. I mean, there's very little we can do. We do have the World Wide Web. And we do, have contact with others like ourselves, with political movements in other countries, even if their governments are not taking a stand against intervention and against militarism and against, in one form or another, aligning themselves or placing themselves at the service of the Pentagon and NATO. You know, the forces within the countries, particularly those that are more heavily politicized and have multi-party political systems, are, you know, representatives of those political formations, parties and otherwise, you know, can be contacted as we do, you know, on a regular basis. We can compare notes. We can assist each other. We can fashion, you know, maybe a keener analytical apprehension of comprehension of what's going on, you know, based on dialogue. That's you know, something we can do. We, as you know, marshaled something in the neighborhood of 20,000 protesters against the NATO summit in Chicago this past May. And, you know, to even explain to people so long after the end of the Cold War that NATO still existed and the very and the nature of it and so forth was an educational task, but it was a rewarding and ultimately a productive one. And initiatives of that sort are possible. And it's important in my estimate that we, you know, build consistently, that we try to sustain the momentum that came out of something like the demonstration and other activities around the summit in Chicago in May, and extend that internationally. We want a world without war. We want a world without militarism. We want a world that doesn't want to wake up tomorrow morning and hear that yet another country has been bombed or attacked. And I'm sure the overwhelming preponderance of the human race feels similarly and are not having their voices heard or their sentiments reflected. And, you know, we need to have not only informationally, but organizationally and politically. We need an international current, if you will, or an international dynamic, an international movement, ultimately, that will reverse the trends we've been talking about so far tonight.
Yes, we do. Well, it's always a question of how to get from here to there, but at the very least, I hope people will start to spread the information that we've been talking about today about the growing threat of militarization and of the globe that comes with this type of organization. Rick Rozoff, Stop NATO International, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you again, James.